Marriage is built on secrets, but some are darker than others. On the surface, Mara believed she knew everything about her husband, his likes, his worries, the little routines that made up their shared life. But the night she stumbled upon a hidden door in their basement, the illusion of safety shattered. Behind that door was a world she never imagined, a meticulously crafted BDSM dungeon, complete with restraints, whips, and a chilling logbook of sessions. As Mara confronted her husband, she expected answers. Instead, she found herself tangled in a web of manipulation, her boundaries pushed, her trust twisted, her dependence deepening with every whispered promise and carefully orchestrated test of obedience. Yet, as Mara's reality warped, so did her resolve. This is not just a story of secrets. It's a battle for power, survival, and identity, where the only way out is to turn the game inside out. So if you think you've heard it all, you haven't. Hit follow on your favorite platform and leave us a comment, because the next story might just change the way you see everything. Don't miss a single twisted turn. Chapter 1. The Door That Shouldn't Exist. Mara always prided herself on being a good wife. She woke early to make coffee, set out her husband's favorite tie, and filled their home with warmth. For years, routine was comfort, but on the night of their 7th anniversary, that comfort vanished. She had gone down to the basement looking for a suitcase. Their family was going to the mountains for the weekend, and Mara was determined to be organized. The basement was cold and musty, its walls lined with boxes and half-forgotten holiday decorations. In the far corner, a shadow caught her eye, a panel in the wall, slightly ajar. She frowned. She had never noticed it before. Curious, Mara pressed her hand to the wood. It slid open without resistance, revealing a narrow staircase leading down, deeper than the basement itself. A rush of unease prickled her skin, but she called out anyway. "Peter, are you down there?" No answer, only the echo of her own voice. Clutching her phone, Mara stepped down, heart thudding. The stairs creaked beneath her. At the bottom, she saw it, a heavy steel door painted black. It looked so out of place in their ordinary home. She, on paranoia. He left earlier for work and returned later, sometimes texting to ask where she was, sometimes arriving unexpectedly just to check in. Mara adapted. She never let her guard slip. She deleted her browser history every time she searched for support groups or legal advice. She kept the flash drive hidden inside the lining of an old purse under a stack of sweaters Peter never touched. Each night she made mental notes, his new routines, his phone calls, the way his hands lingered over his phone when he thought she wasn't watching. The mask of normality grew heavier, but so did Mara's resolve. She realized Peter's pattern. Every act of kindness was a setup, a test of loyalty. If she passed, she was rewarded. Gentle words, soft kisses, long embraces. If she failed, the atmosphere in the house grew cold, and she felt his eyes burning holes through her back. One morning, Peter brought home tickets to a couple's retreat. 3 days in a cabin, just us, away from everything. His voice was light, but Mara saw the trap. Isolation, no phone service, no escape. She smiled, accepted the tickets, but inside she was making plans. Before the trip, Mara began reaching out. She found an online forum for partners of people in the BDSM lifestyle. She read stories, some encouraging, some harrowing. She learned words for what she was experiencing: coercive control, gaslighting, trauma bonding. She realized she wasn't alone. On impulse, Mara posted her own message. If you discovered your partner had a secret life, how would you protect yourself? Answers came back in hours: support, advice, warnings. One reply stood out: gather proof, tell someone you trust, plan your exit, even if you're not ready to leave yet. That night, Mara called Joy from a payphone at the grocery store. Her voice was tight, urgent. If anything happens to me, check the old purse in my closet. Joy tried to ask questions, but Mara hung up before she could explain. The cabin retreat. Peter seemed lighter during the drive to the cabin, humming along to the radio, holding Mara's hand between gear shifts. The cabin itself was picturesque, wood-paneled, surrounded by pines, the air crisp and silent. Inside, Peter set his rules. No phones, no outside contact. This is about us. Mara played along. She let him cook her meals, plan their days, organize games at night. The dungeon here was smaller, a trunk of gear, a few restraints built into the bed frame, but Peter was no less methodical. Each night, he guided her through elaborate rituals, demanding trust and obedience. But this time, Mara was playing a role. She acted eager, even grateful, for his attention. She praised his care, feigned interest in his fantasies, asked for his guidance. The more she pretended, the more Peter relaxed. He opened up about his past, failed relationships, secret affairs, moments of betrayal that haunted him. One night, after a long session, Peter admitted, "You're the only one who's never left. The only one who really gets me." Mara wanted to laugh and scream at the same time. But she kept her mask on, saying, "I want to make this work. I just need to understand." He smiled, pressing her hand to his chest. "Then I'll show you everything." The next morning, while Peter showered, Mara explored the cabin. She found Peter's phone, unlocked on the nightstand. Her hands trembled as she scrolled through messages, old lovers, coded conversations, reminders for sessions. She snapped photos of everything, sending them to a new email address she created just for this purpose. She found his notebook tucked inside his suitcase. The pages were filled with lists, names, dates, descriptions of women and their boundaries, every infraction and punishment meticulously recorded. Mara realized her own name appeared dozens of times, often underlined, with notes like "testing limits," "more praise needed," "monitor calls." The evidence made her skin crawl, but it was also power. For the first time, Mara saw herself not as a victim, but as a player in Peter's game. The power shift. The final night in the cabin, Peter surprised Mara. Instead of guiding her through a ritual, he handed her the keys to the restraints and sat at her feet. "Tonight, you're in charge," he said, his voice low. Mara's hands shook as she buckled the cuffs around his wrists. For a moment, Peter seemed vulnerable, almost childlike. "Do whatever you want," he whispered. Mara realized he meant it. For the first time, she held the power. She could ask anything, do anything, and Peter would submit. She spoke quietly, testing the new dynamic. "Why do you need this? Why do you need to control me?" Peter's eyes flickered. "It makes me feel safe. When I'm in control, nothing can hurt me." Mara nodded. "And when you're not?" He swallowed, unable to answer. She pressed on. "Do you trust me?" Peter nodded, looking away. Mara loosened the cuffs and knelt beside him. "I want you to feel safe, too. But I need trust, not just obedience." For the first time, Mara saw fear in his eyes. The illusion had cracked. She was no longer his project, but his equal. That night, she held him while he slept. In the darkness, she planned her next move. Back home. The morning after they returned from the cabin, Mara woke early. She made coffee, dressed carefully, and took the old purse from her closet. She called Joy, her voice steady. "I'm coming over. We need to talk." At Joy's kitchen table, Mara spilled everything. The dungeon, the contracts, the cabin, the videos, the secrets. Joy listened in shock, then pulled her into a hug. "You're not crazy. You're not alone." Together, they drafted a letter, summarizing everything Mara had experienced and found. Mara sent copies to herself, Joy, and a lawyer recommended by someone from the forum. She was scared, but also relieved. She had taken the first step. The real game begins that night. Mara returned home to find Peter in the basement, the door open, the dungeon brightly lit. He looked up, startled. "Where have you been?" Mara met his gaze, unflinching. "With someone I trust." Peter stepped forward, his face a mask of calm, but Mara saw the panic in his eyes. "You've been talking to people. You're trying to leave." Mara shook her head. "I'm not leaving, but I'm not your prisoner." Peter tried to laugh, but the sound was hollow. "You need me, Mara. You always have." She smiled, cold and certain. "Maybe, but you need me more." For the first time, Mara saw Peter falter. His power was slipping. She walked past him, up the stairs, leaving the dungeon and her fear behind. Chapter 5, Strategy in the Shadows. Mara's world was sharper now. Every sound in the house seemed louder, every movement more significant. Her senses were alive with a cautious hope and a deeper fear. She was no longer just reacting. She was planning. Peter noticed the change. He tried to reclaim the upper hand by drowning Mara in affection, buying her gifts, suggesting weekend getaways. He made breakfast every morning, hovering, watching, always asking, "Are you happy?" Mara nodded and smiled, never revealing what she had truly become. Inside, Mara was moving chess pieces. She began keeping her phone closer, hiding new passwords under fake contact names. She set up encrypted cloud backups for all the files she'd collected. At night, she wrote down every memory and detail she could recall. The women's names, the coded messages, the rituals, the moments when Peter's control slipped. Each evening, Peter tried to lure her back into the dungeon, as if repetition might erase what she'd learned. Mara played along, but this time she set subtle boundaries. She suggested new safe words, requested changes in their routines, and asked more questions than ever before. Peter became suspicious. "You're different lately," he said one night, his voice low. "You're not as eager." Mara shrugged. "People change. You taught me to know myself." He studied her, searching for cracks. For the first time, Mara didn't flinch under his gaze. Reaching out in the quiet hours of early morning, Mara took bigger risks. She reached out to the women whose names she had found in Peter's journals and files. She started with Rachel Kay, the name that had appeared most often. Her message was simple and careful. "Hi, you don't know me, but I think we've both known Peter. If you ever want to talk, I'm here." For days, there was no response. Mara wondered if she had made a mistake, if the other women were too afraid, or if Peter was watching her communications. But then, late one evening, a reply appeared. "Yes, I remember. Let's talk." They agreed to meet at a cafe across town. Rachel arrived wearing sunglasses and a scarf, but her body language was familiar, cautious, self-protective. She looked at Mara for a long moment before speaking. "I always wondered if he'd do it to someone else," Rachel said softly. "He made me feel special, then broke me down piece by piece. He never hurt me physically. It was always about the mind, the rules, the fear that I'd lose his approval. Mara nodded. She described the rituals, the journal, the isolation, the pressure to comply. Rachel listened, tears shining in her eyes. You're not alone, she said. There were others too. Some left. Some, I don't know. The two women made a pact to keep in touch. Mara promised to share any new evidence, while Rachel offered to connect Mara to others who had known Peter. Each name, each story, was a piece of a puzzle Mara was finally starting to solve. A new kind of game. Back at home, Peter sensed that something had shifted. One evening, he found Mara reading in bed, a crime thriller in her hands, instead of her usual gentle fiction. He tried to regain his footing with a game of control, a new ritual, more elaborate than before. He presented a locked box, small and heavy, and handed her a key. This is yours, he said, voice almost reverent. What's inside is up to you. Mara looked him in the eyes. And if I say no? Peter smiled tightly. You won't. You want to trust me. But Mara set the box aside, unopened. Maybe later. Peter's jaw tightened. She recognized the look, the threat beneath the surface. But this time, she didn't apologize or explain. She let the silence stretch between them, waiting to see who would break first. Peter grew restless. He began pacing the house at night, staying up late, reviewing his journals. He snapped at Mara for small things, her tone, her schedule, the friends she called. Mara pushed back quietly. I'm not your enemy, Peter, but I'm not your project either. His eyes narrowed, but he said nothing. Evidence. Mara and Joy met twice a week now, sharing notes and planning next steps. Joy's lawyer friend agreed to take Mara's case, if it came to that. An emergency restraining order, legal protection, even criminal charges, if necessary. Mara kept this information close, only hinting at it to Peter. One afternoon, while Peter was out, Mara opened the lockbox. Inside was a collection of mementos, silk scarves, old photographs, small tokens from women before her. At the bottom, she found a folded letter. It was written in shaky handwriting. If you're reading this, you're not the first, and you won't be the last unless you find your way out. Mara's hands trembled as she read the words. The letter was unsigned, but she knew. This was from one of Peter's past partners. The pain, the warning. It was all there in every line. Mara copied the letter, sent a photo of it to Rachel. Rachel replied immediately. I never saw that box, but I wrote something similar and left it behind. There's more hidden in the house. Mara spent hours searching, eventually finding a small key taped behind a painting in the hallway. It fit a drawer in Peter's desk. Inside were dozens of envelopes, each addressed to a woman. Some were apologies, others instructions, all written in Peter's neat script. The last envelope was blank. Mara left it on the kitchen table, a silent message to Peter. I know everything. Testing the limits that night, Mara waited for Peter in the living room, the envelope in front of her. When he saw it, his face went pale. Where did you find that? He asked. Mara looked at him, calm and clear. I found everything, Peter, all your secrets, all the women, all the games. He tried to bluster, to explain. He said he was sorry, that he was sick, that he needed help. But Mara interrupted, her voice steady and cold. You don't need help. You need consequences. For the first time, Peter seemed truly afraid. Mara didn't threaten him. She didn't shout. She simply told him the truth. I have evidence. If anything happens to me or my friends, it goes to the police, the press, your job. You can't hurt me anymore." Peter collapsed into a chair, defeated. Mara felt the fear drain from her body, replaced by something new, relief. For the first time, she felt the power shift, no longer a victim, but a survivor. But she knew the game wasn't over. She still had to protect herself and everyone else who had ever been caught in Peter's web. Chapter 6. The unraveling Mara no longer tiptoed through her own life. The fear that once shaped her decisions had given way to something colder, sharper, resolve. She was no longer just playing Peter's game. She was rewriting the rules. Each day, she kept her routines unchanged on the surface. She made Peter's coffee, asked about his day, played the role he expected. But beneath the surface, she was building her case and waiting for the perfect moment to act. Peter, meanwhile, was unraveling. He grew suspicious of every word, every movement. He stayed up late, pacing, rereading his journals, and drinking more than usual. Sometimes Mara caught him staring at her with a strange mixture of longing and resentment, as if he couldn't decide whether to beg for forgiveness or to punish her for slipping from his grasp. One evening, Peter cornered her in the kitchen. "Who have you been talking to?" he demanded, his voice dangerously low. Mara kept her face blank. "Joy. Rachel. The truth, Peter. I'm not hiding anymore." His hands balled into fists. "You've ruined everything. I gave you everything." Mara shook her head. "You never gave me a choice, and now it's over." Peter's anger gave way to desperation. He tried every tactic he knew. Sweet words, apologies, gifts, even tears. He promised to change, offered to go to therapy, begged her to forget the past and start fresh. Mara listened, but she didn't believe a word. That night, Mara sent copies of every file, every letter, and every photo to her lawyer, Joy and Rachel. She left a hard copy in Joy's safe with instructions that if she didn't check in by noon each day, Joy should call the police. Peter seemed to sense something was different. The house became tense, as if holding its breath. Peter cooked breakfast, but barely ate. He hovered close to Mara, watching her every move. "Let's go away this weekend," he suggested suddenly. "Just us. We can fix this." Mara smiled coldly. "I'm not running anymore, Peter. I have nothing left to hide." Peter's eyes darkened. He disappeared into his study, slamming the door behind him. That night, Mara slept with her phone beside her, Joy on speed dial. She woke several times to the creak of footsteps outside the door, Peter's shadow crossing the hallway. The confrontation. In the morning, Mara found Peter waiting at the kitchen table. The envelope she'd left days before was in front of him, along with a stack of his journals and the flash drive. He looked exhausted, eyes bloodshot, hands trembling. "You win," he said softly, voice flat. "What do you want? Divorce? Money? To ruin me?" Mara sat across from him, steady. "I want you to get help. I want you to admit what you've done, not just to me, but to all of them." Peter looked away, shame flickering across his face. "I can't. You don't know what I am without control." "I do," Mara replied, her voice quiet but firm. "I've seen it. And I'm done being afraid." He reached for her hand, but she pulled away. "Don't touch me," she said. Peter began to cry, head in his hands. Mara felt a wave of pity, but it passed quickly. She remembered the women's names, the scars they carried, the years she had lost to fear. She would not let him rewrite the story again. The police arrived later that day. Mara and Joy went together to the police station. With her lawyer's help, Mara presented everything, the journals, the flash drive, the photographs, the letters from past partners. She spoke calmly, recounting each detail, not as a victim, but as a survivor. The officers listened. They took her evidence and her statement. They asked if she felt safe at home. Mara nodded. "I'm not afraid of him anymore, but I don't want anyone else to go through what I did." That evening, two officers came to the house. Peter did not resist when they knocked on the door. He simply turned to Mara, eyes hollow, and said, "You were always stronger than me." She didn't reply. The officers led Peter away, reading him his rights. Mara stood at the window, watching the patrol car disappear down the street. The house was silent, but for the first time, it did not feel like a prison. The aftermath. Joy stayed the night, sleeping on the couch. They talked for hours about the past, about what would come next. Mara felt raw but lighter, like she had been carrying a weight for years and only now understood how heavy it had been. The next day, Mara met with Rachel and two other women Peter had manipulated. They shared their stories, their pain, their relief. They hugged, laughed, and cried together. The sisterhood was real, a bond forged by survival. Mara began seeing a therapist, determined to heal the wounds Peter had left behind. She kept the evidence in a safe place, not out of fear, but as a record of what she had overcome. Every day, she checked in with Joy. Every night, she slept a little easier. The fear was still there, a shadow at the edge of her thoughts, but it was shrinking. For the first time, Mara could imagine a future where she was truly free. Chapter 7, The Reclamation. The days after Peter's arrest were quiet, almost eerily so. No more texts asking where she was. No more footsteps trailing behind her in the hallway. No more locked boxes or whispered commands in the dark. The silence left space, at first for fear, then for reflection, and finally for peace. Mara spent mornings in her garden, hands in the dirt, grounding herself. Each night she journaled, not as part of a ritual, but to process, to remember, to remind herself, "I survived." Her world was no longer ruled by Peter's moods or expectations. It was hers, but the real work had just begun. The courtroom. Peter's trial moved faster than anyone expected. The DA built a case not just around Mara's evidence, but around a pattern, multiple women, similar accounts of coercion, control, and psychological manipulation. Though many of Peter's acts skirted legality, the sheer volume and consistency of his behavior painted a disturbing picture. Mara testified. So did Rachel. So did another woman, Emily, who had been too afraid to speak until she saw what Mara had done. The courtroom was heavy with tension the day Mara took the stand. She wore no makeup, no jewelry, no mask, just her voice, calm, steady, unshaking. "He made me feel like I was the broken one," she told the court. "He built a world where I questioned my own thoughts, where saying no felt like betrayal, where silence was safety, but none of it was love. It was control, and I'm done letting that define me." Peter didn't look at her. When the verdict came, guilty on multiple counts of unlawful surveillance, coercion, and emotional abuse with intent to harm, Mara felt no joy, no triumph, just closure. The game was over, rebuilding. After the trial, Mara sold the house. She wanted no more hidden rooms, no more secret compartments. She moved into a small townhouse in the next city, a space filled with sunlight, open windows, and no locked doors. She kept in touch with Rachel, Joy, and the other women. They started a private support group, the Reclamation Circle for women navigating the aftermath of emotional domination. They didn't speak in terms of trauma alone. They spoke of reclamation, of power, of life after manipulation. Mara spoke publicly, just once, at a women's advocacy forum. She told her story in her own words, not as a warning, but as a declaration. Abuse doesn't always leave bruises, she told the room. Sometimes it leaves silence. Sometimes it leaves confusion. But silence doesn't protect you. It protects them. I thought obedience would save me. It didn't. What saved me was truth and the decision to stop shrinking for someone else's comfort. Applause filled the room. Mara didn't cry. She simply smiled, knowing someone out there would hear her words and realize they weren't crazy either. Facing her freaking now in Narsing Gray, Shakbert R. Binkels, Shakri, Seiki Khan one night, Mara stood in front of her mirror longer than usual. For years, she'd avoided her reflection, unsure of who looked back. But this time, she studied her face, the new lines around her eyes, the faint scar on her wrist from a session gone too far. She saw a woman who had been broken but not shattered. A woman who learned the rules not to follow them but to outgrow them. She opened her new journal, not a gift, not a requirement, not part of any ritual, just hers. She wrote, "You don't win by becoming what they made you. You win by remembering who you were before the silence began, and by speaking, even when your voice shakes." She closed the journal and placed it on the shelf beside a small gold key, the only thing she kept from the dungeon. Not as a memory of pain, but as a symbol of her escape. A reminder that no matter how tightly someone tries to lock you in, there's always a way out. Freedom. Spring came early that year. The air smelled of citrus and rain. Mara sat on her back porch, barefoot, sipping tea. Joy texted to check in. Rachel sent a photo of her new tattoo, a phoenix rising. Mara smiled. There were still moments when she woke up in a sweat, flashes of red lights and whispered commands. But they passed quickly now. She no longer ran from the memories. She faced them because they didn't own her, not anymore. She did. Hesitated, then twisted the handle. The smell was the first thing. Leather, faint perfume, sweat, and something metallic. Inside, the room was dimly lit with red bulbs. Chains hung from the ceiling. There was a padded bench, cuffs, ropes, and shelves lined with mysterious objects. Masks, blindfolds, clamps, and, her breath caught, whips. In one corner sat a journal, its cover embossed in gold. Mara's hands trembled as she reached for the book. She opened it, flipping past pages of dates and details. Every session noted in careful handwriting, her husband's handwriting. The room felt suddenly smaller, pressing in on her from all sides. Footsteps, Peter's voice, calm and gentle as always. "Mara, what are you doing down here?" she spun, clutching the journal to her chest. "What is this?" her voice shook. He smiled, but the smile didn't reach his eyes. "It's not what you think." But Mara was already backing away. "How long has this been here? How could you..." Peter's hand was on her shoulder, firm but not forceful. "Let's go upstairs. We can talk about it." Mara let herself be led up the stairs, numb. Her mind spun with images, the cuffs, the whips, her husband's careful notes. At the kitchen table, Peter poured her a glass of wine. He sat across from her, hands folded. "Mara, there are things about me I never told you. Not because I didn't trust you, but because I was afraid you'd leave." Mara stared into her glass. "You lied to me." He sighed, his eyes softening. "I didn't lie. I just kept things private. Everyone has secrets. I promise, nothing in that room was ever used without consent. Not on anyone else. Just by myself. Fantasies. Nothing more. Mara wanted to believe him, but the journal, the equipment, it was all too real. She pushed her chair back. I need time to think. Peter reached for her hand. Please, don't go. Let's talk. Let me show you what trust really means. That night, Mara barely slept. She replayed every conversation, every moment, every missed sign. Was she truly so blind? Or had Peter become a stranger while living under her roof? The next morning, Peter acted as if nothing happened. He made coffee, kissed her cheek, and chatted about the weather. Mara felt dizzy, unmoored. The secret room was all she could think about. Days passed. Mara tried to act normal, but tension simmered beneath the surface. Peter became more attentive, buying flowers, making her favorite meals, complimenting her constantly. But it felt off, like a script he was following to keep her close. One evening, he suggested they explore together. He led her downstairs, gentle but insistent, showing her the equipment, explaining each item, asking her to trust him. Mara's hands shook as he fastened soft cuffs around her wrists, not tight, but firm. He whispered reassurances. If you want to stop, say so. You're always in control. But Mara didn't feel in control. She felt watched, measured. Afterwards, Peter held her and asked, did you like it? Mara nodded, unsure. She didn't want to lose him. She didn't want to be alone. The sessions continued. Peter showered her with affection during the day, and at night, he drew her deeper into his world. He started making little decisions for her, what she wore, what she ate, when she should go out. It was subtle at first, disguised as love. Mara became dependent on his praise, dreading his disappointment. She stopped seeing friends. She second-guessed herself. Sometimes, she wondered if she was going crazy. But deep down, a spark remained. Mara began to notice patterns, ways Peter manipulated her, the praise that followed obedience, the silent treatment after defiance. She started taking notes in her own journal, recording every conversation, every feeling. One night, after Peter had fallen asleep, Mara crept back into the dungeon. She touched the ropes, the bench, the masks. She read his journal again, focusing on the patterns of control. In those pages, she saw her own story reflected, a slow, steady slide from independence to obedience. Mara realized if Peter could create a fantasy, so could she. And maybe, just maybe, she could turn the tables. Chapter 2. The training begins. Mara tried to reclaim a sense of normalcy after finding the hidden dungeon. Each morning she told herself this was just another test, something marriages survived. But each night, the weight of the secret grew heavier. Peter had shifted. He was attentive, yes, but now his eyes watched her with an intensity that felt less like love and more like calculation. At first, Peter was careful to keep things light. He asked, did last night scare you? Mara shook her head, though she still felt unsettled. He smiled, kissing her forehead. I want to show you my world, but only if you're ready. She didn't answer. Instead, she buried herself in chores, hoping the routine would dull the confusion churning inside her. But Peter's patience wore thin. By the third day, he was more insistent. He left little gifts on her pillow, a silk blindfold, a set of scented oils, a key with a velvet ribbon. He whispered at breakfast, trust me, it's the only way forward. Mara didn't know how to refuse. The man she married was persuasive, charming, always able to bend situations his way. If she protested, he became quiet, withdrawn, forcing her to chase after his warmth. If she complied, he flooded her with affection. The cycle made her dizzy. That night, Peter asked Mara to meet him in the basement. He waited by the open door, dressed all in black, his eyes soft but commanding. He held out his hand. Mara hesitated. "Are you sure I'm ready?" He squeezed her fingers. "You're stronger than you think." They walked down the stairs together. In the red glow of the dungeon, Peter's voice changed. "Take off your shoes." Mara obeyed, her hands shaking. He instructed her to stand in the center of the room. He gently tied a silk scarf over her eyes. Every sound seemed louder, the click of a latch, the hum of the house above, her own breath echoing back to her. Peter's touch was gentle but firm. He guided her arms, wrapped cuffs around her wrists, asked her to count to 10 aloud. She did. His tone was careful. "If you want to stop, say red. That's your safe word." She murmured red, just to feel it on her tongue. The word gave her a strange sense of power, even as she surrendered control. Peter started slow. He explained every action, every sensation, the cuffs, the scent of leather, the cold touch of metal against skin. "This is only for you," he whispered. "You can end it any time." He asked her to kneel, then to stand, then to lie down. Each instruction felt less like a command and more like a test of her boundaries, her trust, her willingness to follow. After an hour, he untied the scarf. Mara's cheeks burned, her heart pounding. Peter's face glowed with pride. "You did so well," he praised, as if she'd passed an exam. He held her in his arms, stroking her hair. "You're my perfect girl." The praise felt good, too good. Mara felt a rush of relief, even joy, at his approval. She realized uncomfortably how much she needed it now. That night, Peter was gentle. He massaged her feet, made her favorite tea, watched movies with her until she fell asleep in his lap. For a moment, Mara wondered if things could go back to the way they were. But in the morning, Peter's mood changed. He set new rules. No cell phones in the bedroom. No outside plans without telling me. Text me when you get home. Each rule was framed as a loving gesture for your safety, so I don't worry. But they pressed in around her, invisible walls closing tighter. Mara wrote the new rules in her journal. She noticed a pattern. After every night in the dungeon, Peter became stricter, more protective, but also more unpredictable. One afternoon, Mara's friend Joy called. "Let's get coffee," Joy chirped. Mara started to say yes, but Peter was already shaking his head, mouthing, "No." "I'm not feeling well," Mara lied, her voice tight. Joy didn't buy it, but she let it go. Afterward, Peter hugged her tightly. "Thank you for understanding. We need time together. Just us." The words should have been sweet, but Mara felt trapped. She was losing herself. Her world was shrinking. Just Peter, the house, the secret basement. She tried to push back. "Can we take a break from the games?" she asked one evening, her hands twisting nervously in her lap. Peter's smile faded. He stood silently, letting the silence grow heavy. When he spoke, his voice was cold. "If you're not happy, why are you still here?" The question sliced through her. Was she happy? Was this love? Or was it fear? Fear of being alone. Fear of failing. Fear of what Peter might do if she truly said no. But then, as quickly as the coldness came, Peter's warmth returned. He apologized, brought her flowers, cooked her dinner, promised, "I just want you to be happy. I want to share everything with you." That night, he brought Mara into the dungeon again. He handed her the journal and asked her to write down her feelings, her fantasies, her dreams. "I want to know you," he said. "I want you to know yourself." Mara wrote carefully, watching him watch her. She realized then Peter was studying her as much as she was studying him. Every answer she gave, every hesitation, was another data point in his game of control. The more Mara complied, the more Peter trusted her. The more he trusted her, the more he revealed. He showed her secret compartments in the dungeon, a drawer with old love letters, a box of photographs, a file of contracts and agreements written in his careful script. One contract stood out, a submissive agreement with rules, punishments, rewards. Mara felt chills. "Did someone sign this?" she asked. Peter shrugged. "A fantasy, never used." But Mara didn't believe him. She waited until he was asleep that night, then tiptoed back to the basement. She examined the contracts, the letters. Some were old, some recent. The dates overlapped with the early years of their marriage. She saw unfamiliar names, women she didn't know. Suddenly the walls felt closer, the air colder. Had Peter done this before? Had he manipulated other women the way he was now manipulating her? Mara's mind raced. She copied down the names in her own journal. She needed to find these women. She needed answers. But when she returned upstairs, Peter was awake, sitting in the dark. His voice was soft, almost gentle. "Couldn't sleep," Mara forced a smile. "Just getting some water." He reached out, touching her cheek. "You're all I need, Mara. Don't ever leave me." She nodded, hiding her fear. That night, as Peter slept beside her, Mara made a silent promise. She would not let him break her. She would learn his rules, master his games, and one day she would be the one in control. But for now, she had to survive. For now, she had to play along. Chapter 3. The Masks We Wear. Mara awoke to sunlight streaming across the bed, but the warmth did nothing to comfort her. Peter had left early, a note on her pillow. "Miss you already. Think of me." She traced the letters with her finger, feeling a strange mix of tenderness and dread. Every gesture now carried a double meaning, part affection, part warning. She moved through her day on autopilot, cleaning, folding laundry, reheating coffee. Every now and then, she caught herself staring at the basement door, heart pounding with a cocktail of curiosity and fear. Was this what love became, a riddle with no solution, or had she always been living in someone else's script? Peter checked in often, texting every hour. "What are you up to? Have you eaten? Thinking about you." His affection was constant, sometimes overwhelming. It made Mara feel watched, even when she was alone. But the greatest control came not from the dungeon or the rules, but from the doubt growing inside her. Each time she questioned Peter's intentions, she second-guessed herself. Maybe she was overreacting. Maybe this was normal. After all, he never hurt her, at least not in ways anyone else could see. Still, she started to test the boundaries, small things at first. She lingered on the phone with Joy a few extra minutes. She wore a blue dress Peter had once called too bright. When Peter noticed, he said nothing at first, just narrowed his eyes and smiled. Mara smiled back, pretending not to notice the tension that settled in the room like fog. That evening, Peter suggested a new game. He set the table with candles, wine, and a velvet box. "Tonight you choose," he said, voice low and inviting. "You pick the rules." Mara's heart raced. Was this freedom or another trick? She opened the box. Inside was a mask. Sleek, black, with gold trim. "Wear this," Peter whispered. "Tell me what you want." Mara hesitated, then slid the mask over her eyes. The world became soft and unfamiliar. "I want to feel safe, Chiso." She kissed his side, boy, barely above a whisper. Peter led her through a series of rituals, kneeling, standing, speaking her desires aloud. Each request was met with gentle approval, as if rewarding her for playing the part. The boundaries blurred. Was she really in control, or only given the illusion of it? Later, after Peter fell asleep, Mara stared at the ceiling, the mask still beside her on the pillow. The ritual replayed in her mind, his voice, his hands, the feeling of yielding. She realized Peter was teaching her to crave his permission. The more she submitted, the more he praised her. The more he praised her, the more she needed his approval. It was a cycle, carefully crafted, a dance she hadn't known she was learning. The next day, Mara found herself alone again. Peter had left for work, but not before reminding her, "Remember, no visitors today. Rest for me." She paced the living room, restless. She considered calling Joy, but the risk felt too great. Instead, Mara opened her journal, reviewing her notes, names from the contracts, dates, patterns. She circled the name, Rachel K. It appeared more than once, always in careful script, always attached to words like obedient, favorite, gone. Determined, Mara searched for clues online, using only initials and dates. Hours passed. She found nothing concrete, but her suspicion grew. Peter's past was not just fantasy. There had been others. That evening, Peter returned home in high spirits. He wrapped Mara in his arms, spun her around the kitchen. "Tonight, we celebrate," he declared. "You're making progress. I'm proud of you." Mara smiled, but inside she felt hollow. After dinner, Peter led her to the dungeon again. He had arranged the room differently. Softer lighting, fresh linens, a playlist of gentle music. "Tonight, we'll try something new," he said. He introduced new props, feathers, a soft flogger, a blindfold. Mara complied, but her mind was elsewhere, cataloging every detail. She paid attention to the words he used, the cues for submission, the subtle threats beneath the praise. When it was over, Peter cradled her head. "You belong here," he whispered, "with me, always." For the first time, Mara didn't nod. That night, she waited until he was asleep, then crept downstairs. In the dungeon, she studied the journal. Every session, every praise, every punishment was carefully recorded. She noticed a pattern. Whenever she disobeyed, Peter's affection became more intense the next day. Whenever she complied, he seemed distant, almost bored. Suddenly, the truth clicked. Peter didn't want obedience. He wanted the struggle, the game, the dance of control and resistance. Submission was only interesting if it had to be earned. Mara's rebellion was not just a threat, it was fuel for his desire. Armed with this knowledge, Mara made a decision. She would give Peter what he wanted, just enough defiance to keep him engaged, just enough obedience to make him trust her. She would learn his rules and play by them, but she would never lose sight of her own power again. From then on, Mara became an actress in her own home. She smiled at Peter's rules, laughed at his jokes, accepted his gifts. She submitted when he asked, but always left a trace of her own will, a look, a pause, a question that lingered in the air. She started hiding money in an old shoebox, just in case. She memorized the codes to the locks. She began running again in the mornings, even when Peter told her to rest. Each step was quiet resistance, a reminder to herself that she was not broken. Weeks passed. The games continued, but now Mara was learning. She watched Peter carefully, studying his moods, testing his limbs. She read books on psychology, manipulation, and resilience, jotting notes in her journal. One day, while cleaning the basement, Mara found a hidden flash drive taped beneath a drawer. She pocketed it, waiting for the right moment to explore its contents. That night, after another session in the dungeon, Mara slipped the drive into her laptop. Files appeared, photos, videos, documents. Some were innocent, vacation pictures, scanned receipts. Others were not. Mara's stomach turned as she scrolled through images of women in the dungeon. Faces blurred, but bodies unmistakable. Some files were labeled with names, others with numbers and dates. She recognized Rachel K. in several videos, her voice soft and pleading, the sound of Peter's commands. Mara's breath caught. These were not fantasies. This was real. Tears stung Mara's eyes, but she did not close the laptop. Instead, she copied the files onto her phone, hiding them deep in a folder only she knew. The next morning, Peter was different, tense, distracted, watching her with sharp suspicion. "Did you go through my things?" he asked casually, but his eyes were cold. Mara shook her head, steady. "No, why?" He smiled, but it was all teeth. "Just asking." As Peter left for work, Mara's heart hammered in her chest. She had evidence now. She had leverage. But more than that, she had proof. She was not crazy, not paranoid, not weak. She was surviving, and soon she would take back everything he had stolen. Chapter 4, Learning the Rules to Break Them. The days after Mara discovered the flash drive felt longer and heavier. Every morning, she forced herself into routine, careful not to betray her new secret. Peter, for his part, was attentive, but tense, his eyes tracking her movements with a watchfulness that bordered